Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron will join us in a few minutes to answer your plant questions. You're welcome to email questions to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. But we're going to start the hour with a subject most Iowans cannot ignore: biting insects. Donald Lewis is a professor of entomology at Iowa State University. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And you managed to skip the worst of the biting insect season in Iowa by going to Africa.
I was in Africa where the temperature was actually lower than the temperatures you had in Iowa in May. And although I saw a lot of flies, I was not bothered by the black flies, the buffalo gnats, that caused so much annoyance there in the late May for people pretty much across Iowa.
So maybe you did dodge the most annoying part of the season.
I hope so. I hope that's as annoying as it gets. But, as we say, the weather to come will determine our insect populations, not the weather we've already had. So we'll see where it goes from here.
So let's talk about those black flies a little bit, because they were very annoying, and they show up pretty much every spring in Iowa. They seem to last, about 3 weeks and then kind of dissipate?
We have one generation per year. They emerge from flowing rivers where the larvae live under the water and live in the mud and feed on aquatic organisms and so forth. And then we get these emergences, and people who spend a lot of time fishing down by the rivers see them every year. Most of us may notice a few of them, but then something happens, and I wish I could put my finger on what that is, that we get an outbreak. It's just amazing how many will appear all at once. And of course, it's not what was the weather this May that caused that outbreak. It's what happened over the last 10 to 12 months that produced the outbreak that we saw in May of 2018.
And we won't see them again until next spring, no matter what?
We won't see, right. There will be a few, there will be some lingerers, there will be some other species that may come out and bite us and bother us, but that outbreak of that particular fly, that particular black fly, will not happen again until next year. And I don't remember the last severe outbreak. I think it's been a long time, so we hope it's a long time till we see that number again.
Well, and when they do show up in those numbers, we see some weird things happening with their bites. Some people have strange reactions, a lot of swelling, that kind of thing. Why do they hurt so much? What are they doing to us?
Well, if we compare them to the mosquito is a gentle feminine biter in that she very gently inserts a microscopic stylet into your skin, and you almost can't feel that as she probes around looking for a capillary where she can ingest the blood. Blackfly females are the stabbers of the group. They have this scissor-like mouth part. When they land, they slice open your skin, slobbering in the process, introducing some saliva that may cause part of the reaction, in order to suck up a bit of blood before they fly off and do it again. It's that cutting, biting action that makes them hurt so much.
All right. And they're also easy to inhale and easy to swallow and easy to get in your eyes.
And your ears and under your shirt collar. They're attracted to our face and the back of our head, it seems. It's usually the ears and the eyes and the faces where we notice them the most. And of course, you look a little silly walking down the street, flapping your hands at your face constantly, but sometimes that's what it takes to not be annoyed.
All right. Well, let's talk about mosquitoes. And let's start in Africa, because, of course, when we think about mosquitoes, we think about malaria and some of those tropical diseases, which is a really grave danger in Africa still, right?
It still is in some parts, in some areas. Fortunately, I was in Malawi, Africa, visiting our daughter who's running a research project there. And we were there in the dry season, so mosquitoes were not as prevalent as they could be. But for the world as a whole, and especially for sub-Saharan Africa, there are still 400,000 to 500,000 deaths per year from malaria. So it is still a grave danger and a grave threat. Of course, malaria, like many of our other diseases, is transmitted by the bite of a mosquito. So as she gently bites your pokes your skin to get your blood, she can also introduce those pathogens that cause malaria and other diseases.
So what did you do as a tourist, as a visitor, to stay safe?
Fortunately, we have a lot of good insect repellents, and that was part of it. Of course, being in Africa, the other half of protecting your body is using sunscreen, so you feel a little lathered up and greasy when you go out. The other thing that was a new experience for me is I have taught about bed nets for my whole career when we talk about mosquitoes and what can we do to prevent malaria. When we cover that in our coursework here at Iowa State University, I've talked about bed nets, but I have never slept under one and realized, you know, it's a little inconvenient to have this gauzy net hang all around your bed. And it's especially inconvenient for guys of a certain age who need to be up once or twice per night, and you have to kind of fight your way out of the bed net. But the bed net is a standard operating procedure for tourists especially and for others in Africa as a way to sleep comfortably in a house that doesn't really have very good window screens and reduce your chances of being bitten by mosquitoes while you sleep.
All right. So your entire career, you've been talking about this convenient, easy way to prevent malaria
yes.
And found it maybe not as convenient and easy as you always thought.
You know, I suspect those who grow up with it, those who do it regularly, getting in and out of the bed net is no big deal. But we're talking about a gauzy fabric that hangs from the ceiling or hangs from a framework above your bed and completely encircles the bed. If it's long enough, the fabric puddles on the floor at the bed. If it's not long enough, you have to tuck it in under the mattress to try to create this bug-proof or mosquito-proof area where you're sleeping. And then when you get up, you have to find the overlapping flaps to get your way out. And I just found that an interesting aspect of it that, gee, you know, it's kind of claustrophobic in here to think that I have to sort of find my way out to get up in the middle of the night.
All right, well, let's talk about mosquitoes here. And mosquitoes in Iowa can spread some disease, but they do not carry malaria. So that makes them feel like a minor inconvenience compared to what many people in many parts of the world are dealing with. What's the outlook this year in Iowa for mosquitoes?
It depends on the weather to come. Now, back in May, when we had all those heavy rains early in the month, and then you had hot temperatures in the middle of the month, the mosquito population exploded, according to the Iowa Mosquito Surveillance Program that's run by the Medical Entomology Lab at Iowa State University. And there was a huge spike in the average mosquito population around the state of Iowa right in the middle of May. Since then, that population has crashed and is now lower than it was at this time a year ago. So last year, we had very low mosquito populations throughout the summer. This year, we started very high, but we're back down to low. The rainfalls to come will determine what the population does next.
And how much rain does it take to kind of cause a population bump?
It takes sort of a consistent pattern of rainfall. One heavy rainfall won't give you a lot of mosquitoes, but a rainfall every few days so that the puddles stay full, so the temporary impoundments like bird baths and buckets and barrels that you have in your yard, they stay full but not overflowing. If it rains really heavy, the water can flush from those impoundments and the mosquito larvae go with them. So we just need occasional rain, but it needs to be consistent. It needs to be frequent. So one heavy rain like we had here in Ames on Wednesday isn't going to make the difference. It's if we get additional rains to keep the impoundments full.
All right. Of course, there are some other benefits to rain. Maybe we can handle some mosquitoes. Let's talk about ticks. Are you getting many reports about ticks this year?
This year is typical for the ticks in that there are always two questions. One caller will ask, why are there so many ticks this year? The next caller will ask, how come I haven't seen any? So we don't have a surveillance for ticks the way we do for mosquitoes. We don't have a good population measurement. But on average, it feels average in that some people are seeing a lot. We're getting some calls and questions about them. But it's not an outbreak as far as I can tell. So the cool weather early helped keep the tick population, or at least the noticeable tick incidents, down. But now that it's warmed up and the ground is moist, we'll probably start getting more calls.
All right. Well, I've seen plenty, but I always do. It's a lifestyle choice, I
guess. It's a lifestyle choice. And maybe you're one of those people we call a biological magnet, that if something's going to bite a person, I want to be standing next to you because they're going to go to you instead of me.
All right. Maybe I am the lucky one. Before we get to our break, let's talk about one more biting insect that people like to complain about during the summer, although it's kind of a mysterious one. Let's talk about chiggers. Mm-hmm. What are they?
Chiggers are a tiny mite. In the outdoor world, chiggers are beneficial because they feed on the eggs of other insects and other mites. So they are a predator. And especially in their adult stage, they help us keep the population of other pests down. In their early stages, if the chigger happens to be in an area where you are, or more likely you are in the area where the chiggers are, they will climb up on your body and walk around for a while until they find a place of concealment. Then the tiny mite will begin in those areas of concealment, like under your waistband and at your socks and behind your knees and so forth. They secrete an enzyme that dissolves a little bit of your skin, and then they suck that dissolved skin up. And your skin immediately reacts by saying, ooh, I'm going to wall off that attack. And so now you have dissolved skin with a little wall around it, and the tick then squirts more enzyme down through the walled-off tube, dissolving more skin, sucking up the dissolved skin, and that's how they feed. That goes on for about a day, and then the chigger falls off and walks away, leaving this wound and this little hardened defensive tube in your skin to itch for the next 2 weeks.
And how do you prevent yourself from getting chiggers?
Well, part of it's a lifestyle choice. You stay out of the tall grass, you stay out of the weeds, you stay out of the damp areas with undergrowth where the chiggers might be. Chiggers are rarely in the mowed lawn because it's too hot, it's too dry. So they're usually at the edges or they're along the woodland paths and so forth. So stay out of those areas. Repellents probably don't make much difference. If you've been out in an area where you think there might be chiggers, shower when you come in and then use whichever lotion helps you fight the itch.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about plants, your questions about insects. 866-780-9100 is the number. Our email address, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Donald Lewis, professor of entomology at Iowa State University, and horticulturist Richard Duran will join us in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about insects, your questions about plants. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Donald Lewis, professor of entomology at Iowa State University. And Richard Duran is here, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And we've got a question here from Andrea. I have some bright red bugs that gather in clumps. The body is similar to a box elder, but it doesn't seem to have wings. Right now, they're very tiny. Last year, these bugs stripped my orange milkweed. This year, it's blooming and I don't see them around it. What are they and how do I control them?
I believe we're talking about two different things. The small, oblong, pointed at both ends, bright red bugs in clusters probably are box elder bugs. When we see box elder bugs in the fall of the year, we're looking at the adults that have dark colored wings with a red margin. If you were to lift the wings of the box elder bug adult, you would see that the top of the abdomen is bright red. And since nymphs don't have wings, we see the bright red color. So I think the clusters that she's talking about are the box elder bug nymphs, the immatures. Now, the bright red insects on milkweed could be one of the aphids, or it could still be the box elder bug nymphs, but sap feeders generally aren't a severe problem on well-established healthy plants, so we begin to think maybe something else was going on, but We'll stick with box elder bug nymph as the diagnosis of the moment.
All right. So maybe keep a close eye on those orange milkweed to see what might be happening over there this year.
Exactly.
All right. Here is a question from Travis. He says, I have two apple trees and I want to spray the trees for insects. When is a good time of the year to spray?
Oh, that depends on your expectations and how your kind of your worldview of how much insecticide needs to be applied. If your goal was to produce perfect apples, you would be spraying probably 5, 7, 9 times a year. You should have started when the flowers fell off the tree. That would have been the first spray. The middle of June, there's a couple of other important sprays. And then as we get into the year, there will be two more. So it's a lot of spray to produce perfect apples. And in the home orchard, it's just usually not worth it, Richard.
Also, there's limitations on the products. Many of the home fruit tree sprays, you're limited to 2 applications per year. And so when you have that situation, probably the best time to spray would be around mid-June, maybe early July, those 2 times. But you are limited by the number of applications.
All right. Here's a question from Patty, another insect question. Then we'll get to more plants in just a moment. Patty says, will attaching a bat house to my house decrease the insect population in my yard?
Well, question number one, just because you build it doesn't mean they will come. And that's my personal experience. My daughter and I built this lovely bat house. It was according to specifications. It was as good, well built as it could be. We hung it up. I even went to somebody's attic and got a bat and put it up in the bat house.
Seeded the bat house. Okay.
I even put the bat in there, and as soon as we opened the door for the bat to escape, it took off and it never came back. So just because you build it doesn't mean they will come. If they come, yes, they will reduce the mosquito population. They will reduce the population of night flying insects. Will you notice the difference? Maybe, maybe not.
All right. But it's not a bad idea to put up a bat house. Just keep your expectations in check.
That's right. You know, it's like a lot of other things. We can plant it, but that doesn't mean what we want is going to happen. And it may not happen every year. You can also put up a purple martin house, and you can do these other things, and they may or may not be occupied. But yes, all of these things where we're trying to encourage conservation, where we're encouraging a variety of wildlife, and especially where we're educating others about wildlife diversity, that's a good thing.
All right, so put it up, make it pretty, and keep your expectations low. All right, let's get to the phone. Cecilia's on the line in Davenport. Hi, Cecilia.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I would like to ask if you have an opinion on or advice for something to put under mulch to keep weeds down. I know that, or I believe that one can use newspaper, but can you also use like those large leaf and lawn bags, the 2-ply water-resistant whatever? I have some that had grass and leaves in that I could recycle in that way. Would that work?
Well, some people, like in landscape beds, we use landscape fabric, which is black, which has holes in it, and then
right.
They cover it with basically whatever material. I typically don't use anything beneath the mulch, and the reason for that would be if you have that landscape fabric down and it's a landscape bed, it's very hard to deal with if you want to move something or transplant something or plant something new in the area. It's in the way. So what I typically do is I make sure the area is weed-free to begin with, and then I put on 2 or 3 inches of mulch. And if you do that, that's going to keep out most weeds. You may have things crawl underneath the ground and pop up. When that happens, I probably would dig it up. But when you have 2 or 3 inches of mulch, if you have any weeds that germinate in the mulch, they're typically very easy to pull out because they're actually growing in the mulch, not the soil. So the biggest problem tends to be those perennial weeds that creep under the ground, the rhizomes. They tend to be the biggest problem, and when they pop up, I would tend to just dig them up.
Okay. This is a large patch. It's right next to where we plant tomatoes and peppers and things, but it's an asparagus patch. So there's asparagus there. They're kind of marked as they fern out, but it's in between there. So the weeds had gotten very large, mostly grass, but some dandelion, some creeping Charlie. So I ripped them without removing probably all the way down into the ground, removing their roots. And they're just laying there kind of as mulch right now. Typically, my neighbor would put down newspaper and wet grass clippings, but he's not collecting the grass right now.
Yeah.
Can I put something under those weeds and have it work? They don't really want to pay, you know. It's not a pretty enough investment to put down wood chip mulch.
Yeah, in an asparagus-type situation, I guess I would be inclined to maybe use something like grass clippings if you have
okay.
that option, because let them dry first and then apply
right.
them, and then they kind of mat down pretty nicely.
Right.
If you want to put newspaper underneath there, make sure it's not too much, because if you put, let's say, several sheets
mm-hmm.
beneath the grass clippings, when those sheets dry out, and then it rains, the water may have a hard time penetrating several sheets of newspaper. So if you use newspaper, it should be maybe just one or two sheets, not six, seven, or eight sheets.
Okay, and so definitely the leaf bags would not work as a way of recycling, since they're water resistant.
Yeah,
that would not
right,
be a good choice.
Right, right. You don't want something that's going to prevent water movement.
Could I put newspaper under just one or two sheets under the weeds that are there until we accumulate some grass clippings?
Boy, I would try to get rid of that plant debris, the weeds.
Period,
because some of these weeds may actually re-root.
Right.
They may have seeds present, and I would prefer to get them out of there completely if I can.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Cecilia. Next up, Randy in Iowa County. Hi, Randy.
Hi there. I got three questions. I got a small shaped, I would call it a bohemian plum, and I noticed the other day that the leaves were kind of yellow on the edges. Could somebody have sprayed and dressed it over and did that job to them? And then mosquitoes, they can't handle wind like we got today. So if you're having a party, get some kind of a wind. big fan or whatever.
Giant fan, all right.
Well, when you're dealing with herbicides and herbicide drift, what I typically like to see is symptoms that are pretty consistent throughout the entire area, not just on one plant. If one plant is showing symptoms and other nearby plants are not, then I would suspect it's not herbicide drift or herbicide injury. Your common broadleaf herbicides like 2,4-D, dicamba, they typically cause curling of the leaf margins or cupping of the leaf margins, not yellowing or browning per se. But I want to see consistent symptoms on various plants to conclude it's herbicide damage.
Can I switch over to ticks? I got had a tick on me here about a month ago, went to the doctor, and he said it's a Lone Star tick,
mm-hmm.
which means it wasn't one that will transfer the Lyme disease to you. So, people don't want to go to the doctor, take that tick and go to the library and see if you can find a book that tells you what kind of tick you got.
We have three common ticks in Iowa. The wood tick is the largest one. The Lone Star tick is the medium-sized one and is maybe now our second most common tick. The black-legged tick is the one that transmits the Lyme disease, and it's the smallest of the three. So, yes, they can be identified. We have references from Iowa State University Extension and Outreach, or your public library can give you a tick guide as well.
I think the Lone Star is the most interesting looking.
Well, the female carries a single yellow dot on the back. And from that, we get this name Lone Star tick because it looks like the flag of Texas, I guess. It used to not be in Iowa. I think when I started, we only got a couple of them, and it was always down on the southern border of the state. And the Lone Star tick has gradually moved northward through the time that I've been in Iowa, and we now find it at least in the southern half of the state and probably more like the southern two-thirds of the state on a fairly regular basis. So it's an interesting one, and the female is easy to identify by the yellow dot.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Andrea is on the line in West Des Moines. Hi, Andrea.
Hello. Okay, so I have two questions today, if possible. One of them about peonies. So my peonies are just about done blooming, as everybody's are. And I have, they've been in this spot for 10, 15 years, and they developed mildew issues. So I like leaving the leaves and everything all season, but then they start looking pretty nasty.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a time where is there a way to treat it? If I cut back the foliage, is that going to be a problem? I didn't know how to keep them happy, but.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Powdery mildew is a fairly recent thing. We didn't see this 10 or 15 years ago. It's been a recent thing. We're seeing it quite often nowadays. It tends to be much more widespread, much more severe in partial shade. So if these plants are growing in partial shade, what I would do is move it to a sunnier spot, and I would do that probably in late September, early October.
They are not in any shade at all. They are full sun.
Well, then you can try fungicides. They should work. You'll probably have to put on a number of applications. Now, with the powdery mildew, they're not going to destroy the plants. They will not destroy the plants. Basically, it's aesthetic damage. They look bad. And it does weaken them a little bit.
They weren't.
Yeah, it's not fatal. It's mainly aesthetic. It will weaken them a little bit. But if you want to prevent that, if they're in full sun, then probably some fungicide.
Okay, that makes sense. My other question is about roses. I know you guys talk about them a lot, and I've been listening to make sure that nobody was asking my question, but I have some rose bushes that are I have had in the same spot for nearly 15 years, and they've always come back. They're a shrub climber, not exactly Seven Sisters, but related to, and they have always come back on their old growth every year. I trim them back, I fertilize, do all the things I'm supposed to do, winterize them the way I'm supposed to, and they've always been happy. This year, for some reason, none of the old growth on any of the three of them, none of them came back on their old growth, and they're all growing from the ground up new stuff. And I'm like, oh no, they're unhappy, they're sad, they're going to die, are they on their last legs, are they old, or what happened?
I think it was basically due to our weird winter this past year. Because in November, early December, we had very warm weather, considering the time of year, much above normal. And then suddenly, right after Christmas, it got brutally cold, much colder than normal. So you had this warm period, and then this very sudden drop in temperatures, where the plants maybe hadn't properly hardened off, and so maybe they were more prone to injury. And then we had a kind of a strange late winter, early spring, when we had quite a bit of snow in March and April and very cold temperatures in April, early April. So maybe this winter was hard on them, and therefore they died back more so than normal.
All right. So hopefully next year will just be better.
Right. Right.
All right. Andrea, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Martha, who is on the road traveling through Iowa today. Hi, Martha.
Hi.
What's your question?
My question is, regarding stink bugs, I don't think I'd ever seen one in my life, and now I'm seeing them inside my home. How do I get rid of them from inside?
Pick them up and throw them back outside, suck them up with the vacuum cleaner, sweep them up. You're talking about probably a new stink bug that's only been in the United States since about 1996, 1998. We have only found them in the state of Iowa since 2011. It's called the brown marmorated stink bug. And in the fall of the year, after it has spent the summer in the landscape feeding on sap from plants, they behave like a box elder bug and they come inside. Most Iowans have found a few. In my house, I'm now up to five that I have found in 3 years. So for us, it's a pretty small annoyance and we can generally put up with it by discarding them. Back east in Pennsylvania, New York, and so forth, they find tens of thousands of them on and in their house, and it's a much bigger problem in other parts of the country. But it's a new species, brown marmorated stink bug. It's going to continue to invade the house. We hope it remains just a few. Dispatch them back outdoors.
And you don't want to squish them, right?
Well, they're called stink bug for a reason, and I don't find the stink quite as objectionable as some people, but lots of people talk about it smells like a combination between soap and rotten cilantro. And so it is an annoying smell to some people more than others.
All right. And then if you don't want to smell that, just remove them as opposed to smashing.
Yes, right. Don't smash them. Remove them whole.
All right. Here's a question from Sandy. Last year, I started a raised strawberry bed for my mom. The plants did very well last summer, but a few weeks ago, I started seeing damage to the leaves. Little green worms or larvae have decimated the leaves of many of the plants, but the berries seem to be unaffected. An internet search suggested possibly sawbug larvae. I've been hand-picking them off as the berries are almost ripe. I did mulch the plants over the winter using some very old straw. Maybe that was part of the problem. What can I do?
I'm not sure we have a good answer. Sow bugs are one of the scavengers that will feed on decaying plant material. They aren't too happy to just start on a whole intact strawberry, but they could. Slugs that live under the mulch can also come up and do that. And crickets and some other things like grasshoppers will feed on strawberries because it's a good source of moisture and sugar for them. I think we may have to spend some time in the strawberry patch at night with a flashlight to see if we can pin down who this is. Hand-picking may be all that's necessary. We hate to use insecticides at the time the fruits are ripening, so I wouldn't recommend spraying the patch just yet until we have a better answer. My other answer is pick frequently, pick cleanly.
All right, and does that old straw, do you think that's part of the problem?
No, I think that was a good choice. I don't think that's an additional issue for the problem.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, entomologist Donald Lewis and horticulturist Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension. You are welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about plants and insects. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron and Donald Lewis, Professor of Entomology at ISU. And let's go to the phones. Jim is on the line in Spencer. Hi, Jim.
It's me again. Okay, so I'm thinking I'd like to grow some ginseng, and I just thought that might be something that you would have some information, some pointers on it. Apparently, I have some. I didn't realize what it was, so I got to looking and thinking I'd get those little red berries before the birds and try to plant them. Is that how you do it?
Well, you can. I would say ginseng is very hard to grow. It's very difficult to grow. Most of it is grown in the state of Wisconsin. Ginseng is native to Iowa, but it's difficult to grow as a crop. Very difficult. Basically, it likes a moist, shady location. So that's what it needs, but it's hard to grow as a crop, per se.
All right. So you're discouraging Jim from trying?
Maybe a few in the yard just for ornamental purposes, but as a crop, probably not a good idea.
All right. Sorry about that, Jim. Let's go to Reed in Ames. Hi, Reed. Oh, I think we've lost Reed. Let's instead go to Ken on the line in Cedar Falls. Hi, Ken.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I've got a pin oak tree. It's probably, 3 or 4 feet up from the ground. It's probably a foot in diameter, so it's a number of years old. But this spring, I've got little suckers that are coming out everywhere, and I've never seen that before. And the suckers have got leaves on them, and I kind of researched it a little bit, and I hate to just tear them off. One site I saw, it said to remove the leaves, but don't rip the stems or the little twigs off, so I haven't done anything with it yet.
And so where are they originating, on the trunk of the tree?
Yes, they're sticking out in different places all the way from about a foot off the ground all the way up to where the first set of branches are.
Okay. I'm not sure why the tree is doing that, but I think I would be inclined to leave them at this point, just leave them at this point, and then cut them off, then cut them off back to the trunk later on in the fall or winter. That's what I would do.
Yeah. Like after a freeze or something?
Well, like maybe mid-November or so, or in the wintertime. Yeah. The basic concern is, again, if you cut those off, you're leaving a wound, a fresh wound, that may attract the insect which transmits oak wilt. So I would just leave the suckers there until later on this fall or winter and then cut them off.
Okay. I'll give that a shot.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Ken. Another oak question. Here's Jim in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I've got a red oak in my front yard that's about 15 years old. And the last few years, I've thought I noticed that it was a little sparse on the leaves coming out. Now, this year, about 25% of the branches probably didn't leaf out at all. Any suggestions on how if there's anything I should do, or should I prune that, or what should I do?
Well, it's basically telling you that it's not in very good health. Trees that are not doing well typically produce warning signs. One of those basically would be maybe leafing out late in the spring. When they do leaf out, they have fewer leaves than normal. They may have leaves that are smaller than normal, or you see branch dieback. So I think you're seeing some very strong signs of stress per se. At this point, I would just leave the dead branches in there again, just leave them there, and prune those dead ones out later on this fall. I don't see a need to fertilize the tree. I would water the tree during prolonged dry periods to make sure it has plenty of moisture, and then kind of sit back and see what happens. If you see additional dieback next spring, or you have additional dead limbs, that tells me the tree is in decline, and that decline may be irreversible, that no matter what you do, it may not recover. Now, if it leaves out well next spring, then I would be encouraged by that. But at this point, its condition is kind of up in the air.
Okay. Great. Thank you for your help.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Jim. Next up, Ciela in Fairfield. Hi, Ciela.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have this wonderful old pear tree in my backyard that was here doing well when I bought the house 30 years ago. And almost every year, it provides, you know, several bushels, actually, of good pears. And this year, and some years, actually nothing. But this year, I'm finding that the leaves, and it leafed out well, the leaves are already, many of them, turning yellow. And I just wanted to know if the tree is too old and just on its way out, or if it's because of the strange weathering in the climate recently, or what's happening. Do you know?
Well, it's not an age issue. I mean, it's not just too old. There's something going on, but I'm not sure what it is. What you might want to consider doing is sending a plant specimen to the ISU Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic here at Iowa State.
Okay.
Where a sample can be examined by the staff and see if they can see something. So if you go to a search engine, type in Iowa State University, Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic.
Okay.
It should go to the clinic website where they tell you how to submit a sample as far as what kind of sample they need.
Oh, okay.
How to package it, where to send it.
Okay.
There's a form that you should print out and fill out that goes with it.
Okay.
And you basically send it to the clinic, and they respond directly back to you. But I think someone is going to have to see a sample or a specimen to examine and see if they can see something.
Shall I send the specimen or sample, including some of the yellow leaves?
Right. Typically, what a sample would consist of would be you would go out to your tree, in this case, and you would select two or three branches that are clearly showing what you're seeing, that you're concerned about. But they should be partly live yet. The branches are going to be maybe a foot and a half in length.
So they're
not going to be very big. But you want to pick something that's representative as far as what you're seeing.
Yeah.
And you typically put them in a plastic bag and then send them to the clinic.
Now, our extension service, we have one in Fairfield, Jefferson County. Is that someplace I could take them directly from my tree without anything declining en route, or shall I do what you said and send them off to the university?
I would send them in directly myself if you do it. Now, some counties will do it for you, but they don't have the staff to actually diagnose it. So some counties will send it in for you, other counties don't. But you can send it directly to the clinic, and I would probably suggest that.
All right, Ciela, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Will in Johnston. Hi, Will.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, last bought them. I put some garlic cloves in the ground. They wintered well. They sprouted. I'm just wondering, how do I know when they're ready to pull?
Because the foliage will start to droop over and turn brown. And that's a good sign. It should be pretty soon, in the next few weeks.
Okay, yeah, I did pull one to check it last week, and it just looked like a big spring onion.
Okay, well, most when you plant garlic in the fall, it typically matures in midsummer, so it should be pretty soon.
All right, Will, thanks a lot for your call. Here is a question from Glenda. I have a four-year-old forsythia bush that is growing nice and tall, but has just a handful of blooms each spring. Anything I can do to encourage blossoms?
She may have the wrong variety or cultivar. That may be the problem. There are a number of different cultivars. For example, Linwood Gold is a very common one, but that cultivar is not very winter hardy. So typically what happens is that the flower buds are destroyed by cold winter temperatures, and so it has very few flowers in the spring. Typically go to a garden center where they typically have better cultivars and look for things like Meadowlark, which comes out of South Dakota State University in North Dakota. Very, very hardy. There's a few other varieties too, but make sure that the variety you choose is winter hardy in the Midwest, upper Midwest.
All right, here's a question from Russ. Do mosquitoes tend to not go above a certain height above ground, and what is that height?
We have about 51 or so different species of mosquitoes in Iowa, and the answer to his question is, it depends. Some mosquitoes are tree dwellers. They will be high above the ground, and they may feed primarily on birds. Other mosquitoes may be closer to the ground. So his answer is partly yes, but also partly no.
A treehouse is not your answer. Is that
not for all mosquitoes, but you may face a different mosquito if you lived in a treehouse.
All right. Here's a question from Nate. I have a large shady area of my yard that will need to be reseeded as part of another project. I'm planning to add a top layer of compost from the city landfill. Will 4 inches be enough? Can I do the seeding this month? I'm also planning to cover the seed with maple and oak sawdust to protect the seeds from the birds. Do you think that'll work? So first of all, 4 inches of compost?
Well, I wouldn't try to grow the actual grass in compost. They can maybe add an inch or two and kind of rake it into the upper few inches of soil, hopefully without disturbing the roots of the trees. That's important. I would be shooting for basically, I think, mid-August as far as a seeding date, and make sure they use seed from grasses that are shade tolerant, like the fine leaf fescues. And after seeding, what I would probably do is if they can get a erosion control mat or some straw and place that over the area. And basically what that does, it keeps the ground moist so it doesn't dry out as fast. And then water it periodically and the grass hopefully will come up.
All right. And let's go to a question from Darren in Rock Island. He says, I have an expansive deck from 1 to 3 feet off the ground, which sometimes seems to retain a bit of standing water beneath it after heavy rains. As it's difficult to get directly to the ground, I generally treat by pouring insecticide pellets for lawns, then sweep it into the spaces and water. Is there a better or more effective means for insect treatment, as this is the bane of my outdoor living?
Number one, you don't have to raise your own mosquitoes. Grow your own is a possibility, but mosquitoes can travel such long distances that you may not be growing your own mosquitoes in that standing water under the deck. Remember, it takes 7 to 10 days for a mosquito to go from egg to adult, so that water has to stand there for that week to 10 days in order for the mosquitoes to emerge. If the water goes away faster than a week, that's not the breeding site. Number two, permanent drainage would be a much better choice if that can be done in any way at all. And number three, there are some mosquito larvicides. These are often dunks or pellets that are just for mosquitoes. They're not going to control any other insect. They are selective for mosquito larvae, and we put that into the water where the mosquito larvae will ingest the bacterium of the active ingredient and be controlled. I would like that selective insecticide more than a broad insecticide for turf grass and garden insects.
All right. Here's a question from Beth in Des Moines. Tiny white, this says in quote, worms are devouring my Lysimachia. I'm not sure how to say that for the third year in a row. What the heck are these? I've tried insecticidal soap with minimal results.
I think I would try more insecticidal soap, and I would try it earlier. Her Lysimachia has a history of this insect. I'm guessing it's a sawfly, which is why the Bacillus thuringiensis products wouldn't work, but that tends to be a pretty tough plant. It would be hard to kill, and if it's come back after 3 years of defoliation, maybe this isn't such a serious problem, but either hand-picking or insecticidal soap earlier in the season.
It's not going to be a fatal no.
Yeah, it's hard. It's a hard plant to kill once you have it established.
All right, here's a question from Jim. My garden has been crisscrossed by moles in the last couple of nights. I think they're after the worms that are in there because I covered it with several inches of leaves last fall. Now, thanks to the moles, it's really soft to walk on, which I think is good. But are they harming anything?
Well, moles are annoying because they make those little mounds and then your lawnmower scalps that grass, so you have to keep tamping them back down. But he's right. It's a sponging, aerifying process. He's also right in that mole main meal is earthworms. So most of us have moles who don't have white grubs. Therefore, an insecticide is not going to help because the moles are eating his earthworms. The leaf litter probably didn't make much difference. Earthworms are where there's moisture, well-drained soil, heavy organic matter. So just good soil has earthworms, and the moles may follow.
All right, let's try to get another call in here. Jean is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Jean.
Good morning. I have a boxwood question. We have a hedge that's probably 5 feet deep and about 5 feet tall, and it's yellow practically, I would say 50% of it, from this winter, and it's mm-hmm. never had a problem before. So I also know that way down deep around the big trunks of this thing are lots of little bits of boxwood growth.
Well,
little new shoots. What do I do?
Well, again, I think our weird winter this past year was hard on the boxwoods.
It was.
Boxwoods are kind of finicky anyway, and some of them did really well, and some of them did very poorly. So
that's correct.
I would just prune out basically what's dead and hope it comes back.
So it just cut way back all these huge branches that are dead.
And I mean, if it, right,
if it's the little stuff in the bottom, let those grow too.
Right. If basically the majority of the plant is dead, if those branches are brown, if they're dry, if they're brittle, they're basically dead.
Yes.
And they're not going to come back to life, so I would remove them and hope the new sprouts will eventually recover as far as the plant. But it may take a while for them to recover. They're not going to look quite the same for a while, but they may. Now, if they don't do well again next year, I might consider replacing them with something different.
All right, Jean, thank you so much for your call. And we are out of time, but thank you so much for all of your calls. Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron. Donald Lewis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure.
Donald Lewis, a professor of entomology at Iowa State University. We will be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.